Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today, the title of this show is, for once, correct, as we meet many writers, plural, in the episode ahead. Or at least we look at how you can get to meet 600 of them at the best literary festival in the world. I can only be talking about Hay, the festival that was co-founded by Peter Florence, who's in the studio with me today. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Hay's now in its 31st year, but it began as a family affair. So tell me a little bit about the Florence family.
Well, the salient bits are that my mother, who is an actress, who, bless her, helped fund the whole thing for years. My father was a theatre manager and showman who, in 1969, was working for a inspired lunatic called Sam Wanamaker, for whom he erected a big top tent on what is now the site of Shakespeare's Globe, but was then just the bank side, and ran an international Shakespeare season. And I think the buzz of that is why we do what we do at Hay. It harks back to that incredibly exciting circus coming to town, there's a show to throw, joy of a festival that just brings people together for quite a short period of time, but with all the fun of a celebration and you're right, of a family gathering.
Mm. And did you grow up in the area? Was it a place that you knew well?
Yeah, Hay's home. I mean, it's one of the things we've learned, because we've done this all over the world for the last 30 years, is that it's an awful lot easier if you know who to call at 1 o'clock in the morning to get the loos open, or how to get a tractor to pull a car out of a field. There are special things about doing it at home, but there's also the point of doing it at home. You know, you are, when it's all done, throwing a party and inviting people around to your place. And our place happens to be this jaw-droppingly beautiful Brecon Beacons National Park on the border between England and Wales and the heart of the Wye Valley. And it was loved by the Romantic poets who walked there for centuries, millennia. I say millennia advisedly because there's one of the most extraordinary Neolithic finds of the last few decades has been just outside Hay, a 4,000-year-old gathering point, a moot, that was clearly 4,000 years ago of national significance. It was big enough to hold 1,000 people when there were only 50,000 people in Britain. So what were they doing? They'd found a wonderful place to party. The homeness of it is very important.
And of course, for many years, even pre-festival, it was known as a town of books.
Richard Booth, who was a wonderfully eccentric and maverick entrepreneur, decided to plant himself in Hay in the late 60s. And he opened a bookshop in what had previously been the town brothel and transformed one form of entertainment to another. And it caught on. Rather magically. And part of that is that in those days, before the internet, you would go on a pilgrimage to a book town. And that sort of stuck. He made Hay world famous as a byword for slightly dishevelled, gloriously quirky, intellectual Sherlocking. And it's moved on a little since then, but the spirit of wanting to discover something that you didn't necessarily know about, which is what bookshop browsing used to be, that's still absolutely key to the whole idea of Hay. And now we have wonderful clothes shops and incredible food shops. There are 4 or 5 of the best places you can ever eat are within a stone's throw of our office in Hay. So the town has maintained its deeply eccentric and lovely character whilst trying to make itself a bit more sustainable.
The festival itself then came together really around your family kitchen table.
I'd been, as a young actor, I'd been doing a one-man show about Wilfred Owen, which got invited all over the place. And I went to lots of festivals and thought, these are great. I remember this from my childhood. I remember what my dad did. And we literally thought, let's do the show right here. And invited some friends up for the weekend, and it just sort of caught. And oddly, the more digitally connected we are, the more absolutely vital that sitting around a table, sitting around a picnic rug or around a fire and telling stories and sharing ideas becomes more and more powerful because, A, people are individuated by technology. So the gathering, the humanness of it is really, really vital. So much of the festival this year is about artificial intelligence and progress and scientific development and employment. But people coming together is a very human act. It's not a herd or a tribe. It's a wonderful, voluntary expression of a desire to be with people who might change your life. Mm.
And you've been doing it for 31 years. Tell me about those early years.
Well, we started off in the back room of the British Legion with sort of 35 people. And the idea of it being informal, the idea of it being a conversation, was key to it then. And I think if you were trying to, as we occasionally have to, describe what it is that we do, you're trying when you create a festival to construct some kind of argument, and you are marshalling as many resources and as many people and as many fluid conversations as you can to explore the parameters of that argument. And in that sense, it's exactly the same as it always was. It's just slightly bigger, and we have more access to more resources now. But the principle of wanting to talk about life and death and love is absolutely the same. There's a lot more politics that becomes involved quite quickly. But fundamentally, what you're doing is trying to get people who, and I mean writers, who articulate truths about human life that we all recognize, to talk about what it's like to be in Gaza or in Herefordshire or in the Amazon now. And curiously, a lot of those experiences are shared and a lot of them are very, very, very different. Mm. The golden rule of festivals is that you have to do something that wouldn't be there otherwise. So inevitably, all the economics, all the genetics, all the history, the science, the law, everything you explore tells you a very similar story, that plurality and diversity are wisest and strongest and make you richer. And that in the current climate seems to be an almost controversial idea, but is worth absolutely celebrating and exploring every day.
As you have done for many years now. How do the mechanics of the festival come together?
It's run by a bunch of people who live in Hay-on-Wye who are engaging with as wide a world as we can. We have an amazingly supportive board of people who work in very different industries, in the law and in finance and in publishing, who support us. And we have 250,000 guests who come, people who come from all over Britain, all over the world, who love the conversation. And whilst it feels very communal, I think it's based on a huge desire to exchange, to deal, although it's not commercial, it's a sort of social enterprise. The nuts and bolts of it are you have people who put people up, you have people who entertain people on stage, you have people who feed people, you have people who park cars, you have everybody working together to a common purpose. There was something rather wonderful that happened in 2001. On the one hand, Bill Clinton came to the festival, which was terrific at the time because he just stepped down from being president, and it was a big celebrity fandango, flags flying, media circus. The more important thing that happened was that 3 days before the festival, there was an outbreak of foot and mouth disease 4 miles down the road. And we knew, having paid all the deposits and put up all the tents, that we'd have to cancel the show. And we called a public meeting and explained this. And the young farmers said, no, the farms are all closed. If you shut down the festival, the whole economy goes down the pan. And they took it upon themselves to run the antiseptic foot baths. They ran the car cleaning operations. They manned all the gates into the national park to explain to people who were coming why they couldn't go onto the land because of the in case of infection and disease spread. And at that moment, the festival stopped being the arts festival and became the Hay Festival that was just part of life as much as the cattle auction or the retail businesses in the town. Mm. And that's a wonderful thing. And the Hayness of the Hay Festival is really intrinsic to it. In the same way that the festivals that we run in Latin America or in other parts of the world are all very clearly located in their own communities and cultures. And they are both reflecting and amplifying that local reality as much as we do in Wales.
Mm. So, I mean, that must have been quite a big leap, though, taking it from this very community-based festival, albeit open to the rest of the world, to actually doing it in the rest of the world.
Well, it sounds like a bigger leap than it is. I mean, the magic thing is that that storytelling thing is universal. Everybody does it. And the thing that we in our glorious Anglophone world have to just slap ourselves around the face and remember is that of the 7 billion people on the planet, less than 10% of them read in English. And everybody else has their Dickens and their Hilary Mantel too. And journeying into those other cultures and finding their storytellers is incredibly enriching. And I quietly think that what we learned from food and music and football is absolutely the same for literature and storytelling. A wonderful global influence, fusion, interrelation, miscegenation is enriching and powerful. And there are two quirks, I think, of literature as opposed to any other art form. The first one, which is the truly great thing about books, is that they allow you the extraordinary privilege, which I don't think any other art form does to the same degree at least, of being able to imagine the world from somebody else's point of view. The other thing that literature does is focus all the power in the writer. And you could make the same claim for art, but where books differ from theatre is that they give you the untrammeled, uncollaborative, personal truth of what a given situation is like. You're more likely to know what it's like to be a woman in an Amazonian colonial town from literature than you are from the movies or news coverage. You're more likely to understand what a 19th century English provincial town is like from Middlemarch than you are from anything else. And it's simpler, in one sense, it's simpler to do because you're relying on one person's creativity. Now, I fully respect that publishing is a whole different game, but the idea of writing is relatively simple to produce, provided that you have the genius and the sensitivity and the sensibility to write a story that people recognise. Mm.
You must have publishers clamouring at your door, and it's become such a great marketing point to have your author at Hay. So how do you make the cut?
Well, first of all, publishers have already done the work. They've found the writer. They've edited the text. They've produced the artifact. We're coming along quite late in that process and making a decision about which of the people that they have poured their brilliance and industry into we want to take forward into a live scenario, which is slightly different to which do you think are the best written books that you've come across this year. You read and you think about what goes with what and how you thread different strands of programming together and who will complement and who will contradict and who will provide some extension of an argument or a story. And you try to frame several different sides of an equation. Now, I don't mean that you fall into the trap of balance. You know, that great old BBC problem of if you have people talking about climate change, you have to have a climate change denier. No, you don't. That's nonsense. You try and make the most well-informed, intelligent decision from the available parts of an argument and promote what you believe to be the right thing. But you do want to explore things from many different places. And one of the interesting things about the strength of the publishing industry in Britain is that it's always been very good at publishing British writers. Increasingly, it's getting good at publishing writers from the cultures that the British have touristed into. So I'm always fascinated to read British travel writers, and I'm fascinated to read about the places they've written about from the people who actually live there. I love that marriage. I long for the app that when you land in, you know, an airport or a harbour or a train station, it pings up and says, these are the stories that are local to this place. So you try and put together and flavour as much of variety and complementary adventure as you can. And then you grid it up. Anybody who's ever tried to organise a school timetable will know exactly how this fits. You have to keep all the geography and the history apart. You have to merge the languages and the sciences. You have to give people the opportunity to come across things that resonate, and you have to try and make those resonances more and more possible. So it's a bit of a cooking trick. Mm-hmm. People like a mix of flavour and are always surprised and delighted to find things they thought they knew and were familiar remade and reimagined.
We were talking about publishers, and of course Hay is actually a publisher yourselves, so books such as Bogota 39.
Well, we work with so many writers all over the place who sometimes work in more challenging publishing climates. The Bogota 39 and more particularly Beirut 39 anthologies came about through a project that we started off in Colombia and have worked with several World Heritage and City of Literature sites to identify 39 writers of exceptional talent and promise under the age of 40. Now, it originally started as 40, and then we had this hilarious accident. There was a guy called, I think, Jorge Juaranta, who was on trial for mass murder and drug trafficking in South America somewhere. So we couldn't use the word 40. And then we discovered that 39 is graphically also more beautiful than 40. But then we drilled down into this, and 39 just happens to be the age at which an incredible number of the greatest works of literature were written, including, hilariously, 100 Years of Solitude. It happens to be on the curve of many literary careers, a stepping-off point where great masterpieces have been written by people under the age of 40. Mm.
And great literary careers are made at Hay. I mean, people come in their thousands to see their heroes, but they also come to see debut authors.
Yeah, and I think they go away thinking that's the discovery they've made. The Hay audience are remarkable in one regard, in that 85% of them come from more than 30 miles away from Hay. So when they go home again, the boom from Hay can be quite big. A wonderful thing happens at festivals with audiences, in that word gets round. In a matter of hours, a new author, and this has happened to people like DBC Pierre and Amanda Foreman and Owen Shears and a bunch of people who are quite starry now, arrived relatively unknown. It happened to Arundhati Roy, who turned up in Hay, I think, long before she'd won the Booker Prize. I think the book was just about to be published, and she came on stage, and it was quite strange because people would arrive after the event had started because friends were phoning their friends to say, this woman is incredible, you must come and hear. I mean, bizarre. By the time the event had finished, there was a huge queue. More people were at the bookshop trying to buy the book than had been in the event because they'd heard about it. But 15 years later, if you were to add all the people who say, yes, I was there when she did that, they would fill the whole festival site five times over. They're good at latching on to people who are brilliant and recognising them. But they're quite a tough crowd, the Hay audience, and they know stuff. And they're very widely read. And, you know, there's that wonderful old thing we stuck on a T-shirt one year of Ian McEwan, who said, I don't do research anymore, I ask the audience at Hay. Because for years, he came and sort of dry ran his work in progress. And I remember listening to him and this hilarious moment where he said, oh, listen, I'm writing this thing set around the Second World War. What sort of ceramic would they have had in an Edwardian house? And five people in the audience went, well, and that became. So there are lovely things like that. We have Margaret Atwood coming this year. And I know that of the thousands of people who are coming specifically to hear her, they will have all their hopes gloriously met, because she's just extraordinary. She has this sort of amazing, benevolent, wry wisdom about the world and about books that is just immediately appealing. But they're going to find a bunch of young, relatively unknown writers who they'll go away think, that I didn't know. Mm. There are discoveries and there are homages that are paid and there are heroes that are met and sometimes heroes that are made.
And so what can we expect for 2018?
Well, we have, I think, for the first time in Hay in Wales, an absolute gender parity this year, which we've done in other places before, but never yet here. So that, on the one hand, feels pertinent, on the other hand, feels long overdue, and on, as it were, the third hand, feels like just good marketing, because we have a largely female audience, and I'm not suggesting that they necessarily read, for the most part, female writers, but we've never come across the same degree of engagement as we have with Margaret Atwood and Rose Tremain and Jeanette Winston, for any male authors, actually. Perhaps only Seamus Heaney, who, for all sorts of reasons, is a slightly exceptional case. So, yes, this year there is a wealth of wonderful international fiction. There are some important political arguments to be made, not just about Europe, which features a lot, or indeed about America. And we've brought over Donna Brazile, the former Democratic Party chair. We have John Sopel, we have Michael Wolff, we have a bunch of commentators, but also some extraordinary practitioners. But to marry the interest in America, there is a huge degree of highly informed comment and imagination being applied to Russia, because our relationships with Russia are more challenging now than I can remember them ever being in my lifetime. It seems more combustible than it was towards the end of the Cold War. It feels far less safe. And I think people want to talk about that. Equally, there are, in this 70th anniversary year of the NHS, extraordinary things going on in science that will transform the way medicine is produced and distributed and consumed, and it will have an amazing effect on our lives. People like Ed Bulmore and Daniel Davis are rethinking huge parts of what has become our basic model for treatment of people with either degenerative or inherited diseases or depression. And I think that's extraordinary. But the mix of people who understand about the soul and people who understand about the heart and the arterial system is very rich and rather wonderful, because you can't divorce the person from the body.
There are so many aspects of Hay that it would be impossible to go into all of them. I know that you have a whole environmental and sustainability arm. There's a whole Writers at Work programme going on. So many different areas.
The Writers at Work thing is really sweet, actually, because it becomes apparent when you meet writers, as your listeners so regularly and beautifully do, that a lot of them don't have the kind of support networks that you would if you were working in a more overtly collaborative industry. So Writers at Work is a way of connecting up a whole bunch of emerging writers with their peers, their heroes, their seniors, people who mentor them, people in the industry who can begin to help them and connect them, because it's lonely work. Literally lonely, in the sense that you're doing it for the most part in your own study, shut off from the outside world. But also, so much of the creativity is something that many writers feel they don't want other eyes on. So the idea that there are other people who are going through the same thing as you and with whom you can share the experience of writing, if not even the actual text, is really valuable and enriching. And the group we've had for the last 2 years have been winning awards left, right and centre in the last 6 months, which feels like a wonderful validation of the whole project.
When you talk about shared experience, that really is what Hay is about. For people who've never been there, it really is about a whole group of people coming together to do this thing that's quite often done in solitude, reading. But it's wonderful to be doing it, or to be talking about doing it, with all of these people where you can get fabulously artisanal made ice creams and drop into a bar on the way if you so feel.
You're so right. The lovely understanding of Hay is that you take this very private, personal thing and share it. And we always say that the queues in Hay are one of the great joys of the festival. You only have to turn around to the person next door and say, hello, and you're away with people who want to share stories and people who enjoy the idea that you've come together to share stories. You know, in Catholic countries, they do this around saints' days. You know, you put a woman in blue up on your shoulders and carry it through the town. It's a bit like the Grand National. It's the week in the year when people are focused on books, and we get this extraordinary media support for the idea of Hay being a week of celebration that starts in this field in Wales, but resonates out through the airwaves, through print, and increasingly, this is where podcasting and streaming become amazing. We have people from all over the world who are tuning in to watch Margaret Atwood live on a stage in Hay on Wye, or Richard Dawkins, or Bill Bryson, or whoever. There's a wonderful sense that you can now look at the experience of being in a field in Wales as universal. And that's sort of bewildering. We've always thought that what we wanted for the kids in Hay was for them to feel as advantaged as people who live in North London or Manhattan or Paris or wherever else. You have the same aspirations. You have the right to the same expectations of excellence and adventure wherever you live. And my joy is that for a week we get to throw open our doors and say, come round to our place. Mm.
And those children, of course, Hay Levels exists. You have a whole education programme. And if people can't be there, as you say, they can actually watch many of the events being streamed live. They can also ask their own questions, which for me, chairing a lot of sessions is very helpful. You can go on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook and tag at Hay Festival and use hashtag Ask Hay. I think that's a wonderful way just to get audience involved if they can't be there on the day.
It absolutely is. And one of the things about writers is that they know stuff. We have about 200 top academics at Hay. These people are the experts who some people don't want to hear from. Well, I want to hear from all of them. I want people who know about things to be the ones who are explaining things. If you want answers to anything from the price of fish to why we're leaving the EU or how they fixed the ozone hole or what rocket science might mean for modern medicine, then there are people who know some of those answers.
Plus, it's a fantastic party.
Yeah, it's a great party.
Peter Florence, thank you so much for coming on to talk to me. Hay Festival happens in Hay on Wye in Wales from May the 24th to June the 3rd. You can find more details at hayfestival.com. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Kieran Banerjee. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.